the Center for Internet and Society Internet Law Program at the law school. We have conferences, speakers, we have a that deal with matters of public interest and the internet, like free speech online, and we help students learn to become good lawyers. Today I'm going to talk about the law of exploits. I think there is a lot of concern in the community about new laws, particularly the DMCA, which may regulate the distribution of exploit code. And I'm going to talk about some of those laws, possible theories of legal liability, and talk a little bit about what we might be able to do about it. Vulnerability disclosure has been a real area of interest for me, and we are planning a conference in November at the school, which I hope people will sign up for the mailing list about. I'll have a slide with information on that at the very end. So the focus of my presentation today will be to discuss the current status of the law, highlight legal issues which are unresolved or unaddressed, and to maybe quell some concerns about potential liability for disclosure of computer security flaws and vulnerabilities, and possibly raise some concerns as well. My point is, and what my goal is to try to encourage more involvement from the security community in the legal decision-making process. And this is a particularly important time, I think, for people who are knowledgeable about computer security to begin to get involved in these issues, because a lot of states and state legislatures are considering state DMCA laws which could have an impact on security reporting. So, you know, while people may often feel that don't have any control, and the federal government seems far away and difficult, you can have maybe more influence at the more local level at the state. So, it works. There's a debate in the security community that's been raging for several years now about whether the disclosure of computer security vulnerabilities is a net good or a net bad for security. On the positive side, the publication of security vulnerabilities increases public awareness of what the security risks might be. This is good because, as the public, first of all, it's your kind of consumer right to know whether your information and data is safe and secure or not, but also because the consumer can then make good decisions about risk. The consumer can decide, do I want to give my private data? Do I want to store it in this fashion? Do I want to give it to this company? It's better. You're operating from a position of knowledge. The disclosure enables system administrators to fix the problem. Disclosure and the public outcry that sometimes can follow from that motivates the vendor to fix the problem. And disclosure means that everybody's on the same page. No one has an unfair disadvantage because they have more information. The good guys know what the bad guys know. The downside of security publication is that once information is out there, more people know about it and could potentially take advantage of it. The time between when the information is disclosed and a patch is made available has been called the window of opportunity. So people know that the problem is out there, but there's not yet a cure. And that window of opportunity is a security risk for companies. Companies also have other problems with disclosure, one of which is public relations problem. There's a real concern that there's a real concern that the seriousness of a problem can be overinflated in the course of disclosure, and that customers will be more concerned than they need to be. I have a case right now where a former employer disclosed a security vulnerability in the way a company was doing webmail. And one of the things that really got the company upset was that he wrote in his disclosure, "This will allow anyone on the internet to get a hold of your email." And in fact, it was a smaller, much more narrow classification or category of people who could take advantage of this flaw. It was people who would have access to website logs. So they were really concerned about that because customers were freaking out. And the misrepresentation of the relative seriousness of the problem is a legitimate concern. The final problem is the one that people talk about the most, the problem of script kiddies. The idea is that while there are only so many people who have the skill necessary to discover the problem in the first place, once that problem is revealed, and if it's revealed with exploit code or code that can be modified to be exploit code, you've exponentially increased the number of people who have the ability to take advantage of it. I like to think of this problem as sort of a kind of a kung fu problem. In the kung fu movies, the guy who's learning has to go through a whole process of being educated. And with that process of learning how to be a martial arts expert, he's inculcated with the values of the discipline. And so he knows that he's not going to use his deadly skill, except if he really has to use the deadly skill. And there's a culture, an acculturation, and a value system that comes along with obtaining that level of skill, compared to giving a kid a gun, where somebody could just go nuts. It's not so much that there's even more bad people out there, but I think the idea that. Or that the knowledge itself is dangerous, but that the knowledge falls into uneducated hands. The problem is, an essential reason why this is such a debate with security is because security publications have a dual nature. The same information that allows the exploitation of vulnerabilities is what is required to fix them. So there are several sort of outstanding debates or issues about this topic. Now, my presentation is going to focus on exploits and exploit code. If talking about security vulnerabilities absent code is inarguably legal, except under certain circumstances, which we'll talk about, because you're talking about something that's just pure speech. The real issue is code, because code has a communicative aspect, certainly, but also a functional aspect. It can be used in order to gain unauthorized access. So the problem, though, with saying, well, exploit code can be used to exploit, we have to get rid of it, is that both the exploit code and the patch tell people something about how the vulnerability works and how it could be exploited. Okay, so questions also, other sort of security issues are, how can the public judge the relative seriousness of the problem when they are technologically not astute? How does the vendor judge the relative seriousness of the problem? What's the standard of care for fixing these problems? How does the vendor authenticate it? And what's the motivation, really, for the person who discovers the vulnerability to disclose it in a socially responsible way? Right now, the way things work is companies publish their software and it has vulnerabilities in it, and I believe that that's an impossible. I think that quality assurance could certainly be better, but I think given the complexity of software, there's always going to be some vulnerabilities, and then it gets quality tested in the real world. And the people who are doing the quality testing right now, what's their motivation? Mostly it's a combination of interest and interest in building their reputation. And the way you build a reputation is you disclose the fact that you found this vulnerability. That's not a viable economic model for the debugging of software. There's something inherently wrong with that. And there's no incentive structure in place for responsible reporting. So there have been proposals to create doctrines of legal liability for the distribution of exploit code. What are potential sources for legal liability? Negligence. Negligence is a tort, and you have to prove that there is a duty of care and that the discloser violated that duty of care. We don't really have a duty of care. There's nothing that has been, there's no real agreement on this is the duty. And you also have to owe the duty to the party that's suing you. So negligence is a possibility if you could say that there was a duty not to publish under certain circumstances. Strict liability is another possibility. Strict liability is liability imposed for something that is inherently dangerous. So you could say, well, exploit code is inherently dangerous. The problem with that is, as I said, the exploit and the patch and the information that are contained in it, it's a dual nature. Both, it's what's needed to cure is also what's needed to exploit. Conspiracy is an agreement to do an illegal act. People who were at the hacker court yesterday know this. Conspiracy is an agreement to do an illegal act with the intent that the illegal act happen, plus an overt act or effort in furtherance of the conspiracy, something to push the conspiracy forward. And under certain circumstances, the publication or distribution of vulnerability information could be an act in furtherance of a conspiracy, but you need to have these other elements. You need to have the agreement. So, for example, in a case in the Ninth Circuit, somebody was convicted of conspiracy for mailing through snail mail to his friend instructions on how to make PCP. And while the distribution of the PCP instructions is not itself criminal, because it was part and parcel of this overall agreement to manufacture PCP, that was legitimate grounds for his conviction of the conspiracy. Aiding and abetting is another possible theory of liability. What kind of, as with conspiracy, additional facts have to go into, there has to be additional elements in order for there to really be liability for aiding and abetting. The factors regarding when pure publication can be aiding and abetting a crime were set forth in the Paladin Press case. This was a case where Paladin Press, which some of you may know, I personally own their book, How to Set Up a Meth Lab, which I own for a legitimate reason, which was that I had a case involving an alleged meth lab. Actually, the neighbors called the police and said that there was a meth lab. And the police went to the house without a warrant. They said they smelled bleach, and so they thought there was a meth lab, and they went inside and found instead a marijuana farm. So I wanted to say that the smelling of the bleach is not a sign of a meth lab, but I didn't know how to make meth. Now I do. I bought the book, and you don't use bleach. So in this case, Paladin Press published a book called Hitman's Guide to, it was for hitmen, it was how to be a hitman. I forget the whole thing, but it's called The Hitman's Guide to whatever. And somebody purchased this book and used it to be a hitman and to kill somebody else for hire. So the surviving family of the person who was killed sued Paladin Press. Why didn't they sue the actual hitman? Well, he probably didn't have any money, so they sued Paladin Press. And the court upheld the finding of liability against the publisher of this book. The factors that went into the, under an aiding and abetting theory, and the factors that went into this analysis were that the book's expressly stated purpose was to instruct prospective criminals, that the text promoted crime so highly that the jury could reasonably conclude that the publisher's intent was to instruct criminals how to do this crime. The publication was marketed primarily to murderers and and other would-be criminals, demonstrating that the audience was prospective criminals who would use the book for these illegal purposes. And the book had no alternate communicative value behind, besides the illegitimate one of instructing people how to commit these crimes. The interesting thing about aiding and abetting liability, different from conspiracy. Conspiracy requires the two people to agree. In aiding and abetting, there doesn't have to be any actual agreement. So that can be a potential area of liability. It's sort of interesting, something that Fyodor pointed out to me as we were talking about this today, is that how you market what you publish can be just as important as what your publishing actually is. So if you publish it and say, okay, everybody, let's go break into these computers, obviously it doesn't take much common sense to know that's going to look a lot worse to a jury, but the law actually may treat that circumstance differently from if you publish it as, this is something that I'm sending out to help people. Is there a question? So the question is, what if they had written the book with sort of the conceit being that two policemen were just talking about the bad things hitmen do, and otherwise substantively it was the same, and they marketed it to different people, or to the public at large, or to policemen? And I love questions like this, because I always get these hypothetical questions where if you change one fact, then the person wants to know what the end result would be. And the answer is, in the law, we don't have clean answers like that. It's so rare in the law where you can just say, this is the answer. Usually it's a totality of the circumstances, and we sort of analyze all the facts, and we make it complicated. That's how we keep ourselves in business. But I think the answer to your question would be that that would definitely make a difference, because it's either a ghost or... I think that that would make a difference, because it would look different to a jury, potentially, and it wouldn't fit under these factors. So I do think that presentation matters in this calculation. Change one fact, take it to trial, then appeal it, and we'll know for sure. But I do think that would matter, because this is the case basically says these are the four factors that were so overwhelming that we found that aiding and abetting liability was appropriate. Eli. No. They lost. Another question? Okay. So aiding and abetting liability. Potential wire fraud liability. Wire fraud is a electronic communication which is made with the intent to defraud. Intent to defraud is a very broad concept. So I think there's some theoretical possibility that the distribution of vulnerability information or exploits could fall under that. There may be state statutes that prohibit this type of stuff. But the two most important sources of potential liability, criminal and civil, are the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is a federal law, the DMCA, and the Council of Europe's Cybercrime Treaty, which is now signed and approved by 32 countries, including the United States. So let's talk a little bit about those two laws more in depth. The DMCA is a federal statute which is an implementation of the WIPO Treaty. There are different versions of the DMCA. Our version is not the version that is demanded or required by the treaty. There are some variations in international law, variations between our law and the law of other countries that are signatories to the WIPO Treaty. For example, some statutes in other countries prohibit the circumvention of copy control as opposed to access control. And we're going to talk about this in a little bit further. Some countries focus only on the protection of copyright rights. Our DMCA protects far more than copyright rights. So let's talk a little further about that. What does the DMCA do? It prohibits circumvention of technological measures that effectively control access to a copyrighted work. Okay, so controls access, not controls copying, but controls access. So actual circumvention is prohibited, but it also prohibits the manufacturing and distribution of technology that is either primarily designed for the purpose of circumventing, has limited commercially significant purposes other than circumvention, or is marketed for use in circumvention. Okay? So these are tools which are usable for circumventing technological protection measures. Okay. There are some exceptions to the DMCA, but let me talk about this a little bit more and talk about some examples of technology that are forbidden by the DMCA. So something that effectively controls access to a copyrighted work is something like a digital rights management scheme, but it can be something more than that as well. For example, mod chips are probably devices or tools that violate the DMCA. I had a case on this, but you know, essentially a mod chip is something you can put into your like PlayStation or Xbox, which will enable it to play games other than the games that are approved by the company. So some people want to mod chip their Xbox because you can then run Linux on it. But you can also run games that you yourself have written, but it also lets you run games that don't have the little code in it that says, I'm an original copy, not a pirated copy. And that's why it's considered a circumvention device. It gets around that little question that the box asks the software it's running, are you the original copy of the game? The mod chip also defeats another thing that the companies have coded into the games, which is region coding. Companies can sell games or DVDs or music at different prices in different parts of the world. What we pay for a DVD is not a price that's really competitive in other countries. But how do you then prevent people from going to the other country, buying the cheaper DVDs and importing them and selling them here at a lower price and undercutting what the company wants to do? This is their business model. And so they have encoded region coding where our DVD players will play DVDs from this area, from the United States, but it won't play DVDs from another area, say China. Mod chips can circumvent that as well. Now, there was an Australian case that involved a challenge to mod chips and whether they were circumvention devices. And in Australia, the court ruled that mod chips were not circumvention devices. That is under the Australian version of the DMCA. And that act focused on the question of whether the device was designed to prevent or inhibit copyright infringement. Okay, so the copying is the issue in the Australian statute. And because region coding was not a copyright right, it's in Australia, it's not a copyright right here. The copyright rights involve copying, distributing, and performing. The court said that circumventing an access control which promotes region coding is not a crime under Australian law. Now, our law is different. Our law prohibits access to, prohibits getting access to the copyrighted work, not something which enables the copying of it. So in our country, we had the DCSS case. And in this case, somebody in Norway wrote a program which cracked the encryption on DVDs and enabled DVDs to be played on non-approved DVD players like a Linux machine. So instead of getting the software, licensing the decryption software from the company and having an approved DVD player, you could play it anywhere. It really didn't have anything at all to do with copying the DVDs because you can copy them in the encrypted format and play them on a DVD player because your DVD player has the encryption decryption software in it. Basically, this was about playing it in another format. And the case, which was Universal Studios versus Corley in the Second Circuit, said that this was circumventing an access control and was illegal under our DMCA. This DCSS program is to computer programmers who can read code tells you something about a flaw in CSS, the encryption program for DVDs. Similarly, I believe it was 2 years ago after this conference, a Russian programmer was arrested for distributing, for having written software sold by his company that decrypted the encryption scheme that Adobe used for their ebooks. And this would then allow you to copy ebooks and to play them on, in, you know, when you would download it, it would be encoded so that it would just play on your one machine and you couldn't transfer it to other machines. This allowed you to transfer it to other machines, either as infringing copies or simply because I've downloaded it at home and I actually want to read it at work. In this case, the court held that that program was a circumvention of an access control and that the program was not, that as a legal matter, the program was not, as a legal matter, the program came under the prohibitions of the DMCA. Now, subsequently, they gave the programmer diversion, and they tried the company criminally, and the company won after jury trial. Now, you know, the lawyers get to ask the jury why they decided the way that they did, but those aren't published decisions, so it doesn't have a precedential effect. What does have a precedential effect is the decision of the court saying that this was not, that legally this was, legally this came under the DMCA. Another case, which is recent and sort of shows you the very broad reach that the anti-circumvention provisions have, is the Lexmark case. Now, companies that sell printers kind of have this sort of razor blade model for it. They sell the printers kind of cheap, but they make the toner cartridges expensive. And the way, in order to make you buy the approved toner cartridge, they have a little chip in the printer and a little chip on the cartridge. And the chip in the printer says to the cartridge, are you an approved cartridge type? And the cartridge says, yes, I am. And then you can use that cartridge. Well, what this company did was they reverse engineered that protection measure on the chip. And they then created chips that knew the answer to the question, are you approved? And then they marketed those chips to companies that wanted to sell to other toner cartridges, other toner cartridge companies who wanted to make it compatible with this printer. So the court, in reviewing this, they were challenged in a civil suit under the DMCA. And the court reviewing it said, you know, basically, we're not really circumventing anything to get access to a protected work. We're really circumventing it so that we can build something that's interoperable, and so we can put these toner cartridges in this printer. And what the court said is, when you reverse engineered that handshake question, what you do then is you allow access to the software that's on the chip that runs the printer. And by circumventing that, you're gaining access to the algorithmic routines of the printer software. That software is a copyrighted work, so you're accessing it. So this is a violation of the DMCA, as a legally, and allowed the case to go forward. So this case is, that was in the trial level. The case is now on appeal, and we'll be waiting to see whether the appellate court thinks that the DMCA actually reaches this far. I think, do you have a question? I wasn't the lawyer in the case, so I don't know what they thought. I think that the basis for the question was, why did the jury let Elcom, the company Elcom, off the hook? And I think the basis for the decision was that they felt the company didn't have criminal intent. The program was legal in Russia. They don't have a DMCA. And they felt that the company didn't have the requisite intent to violate the law. That was my impression from talking to the, I mean, you never know exactly why juries do what they do, but that was my impression from talking to the lawyer, that it had to do with a lack of requisite intent. Question? There's no and, it's an or. It's one, it's any one of those. That's why I put that or in capitals there at the end of the second line. It's any one of those will bring your technology under the DMCA. Question? It's an excellent question. His comment was that you know, we used to have copyright and patent and trade secret law to be the protectors of commercial interests, but with the advent of computer technology and the ability to have digital rights management schemes, and then this legal protection for digital rights management, it seems that we're kind of enshrined in the law, or permitting in the law, a lot of anti-competitive behavior on the part of companies. And the Lexmark case is a great example of that. And I think that when, and I feel that, you know, there's a lot of other examples too of how companies can basically enshrine their business model in technology and then receive legal protection for that business model through the application of this DMCA law. Now, when I brought that comment up in a lunch meeting at my school, a business law professor had a completely different reaction to it. His reaction was that, well, look at how cheap printers are, and that there was actually a net social benefit to allowing the company, to just using the Lexmark case as an example, to allowing that company to have their business model be cheap razors, expensive razor blades. And you know, the other argument why you would want to protect the company's business model is that it is a payback for them for doing all the complex research and development that goes into making the technology in the first place. I was talking with my boss the other day, and he had just read a book that a friend of mine wrote about becoming a lawyer, and his first case he worked on as a lawyer was a printer cartridge case. And he talks in the book about how complicated it is to get the printer to spray just the right amount of ink in just the right format on the paper and have it all come out dry so it doesn't smear. And my boss was saying, you know, now that I see how much work goes into making these printers, I feel a little bit differently about the Lexmark case because I want the company, you know, I like my laser printer too, we want the company to have some sort of financial, you know, payback. I think the retort to that, because I agree with you, I'm on your side about this, I think the retort to that is that we have balance in other areas of the law. Copyright law is a balance. Patents are not balanced, but they're for a very limited time. In this arena, there's no real balance. This is a very sort of lifetime protection for any kind of digital management scheme that you can impose on your product, and that has some concern. There are exceptions to the DMCA, which we're going to talk about next, and some people may feel that those actually provide the balance, and we'll go through them and talk about that. So, Kim. So Kim's question is, do they have to, as I pour some water on my new computer, Kim's question is, do they have to create a competing product for liability, or is the liability, does the liability attach at the point that they've simply accessed the copyrighted work? And it's at the point that they accessed the copyrighted work. How come?
Thank you.
so our question is, why don't other technologies like toasters, for example, get that same kind of protection? And it's because the statute by its terms doesn't apply to toasters because it doesn't involve this copyrighted, it doesn't involve access to this copyrighted material. And I think the statute was initially, the press for the statute came from the content industries, from the RIAA and from the movie industry. But the way that the statute is written, it's very broad and covers, you know, all these circumstances, including the Lexmark circumstance that we discussed. But it just doesn't cover toasters. I think the idea is sort of, if it's a good idea to protect business models, why do we protect the business model for the printers and we don't protect the business model for the toasters? So the question is, his question is, if you slap a chip in it, can I get protection for it under the DMCA? And I think the answer to that under Lexmark is, well, if what you're doing is circumventing some kind of access control that allows access to the software that's embedded on the chip, then under the holding of Lexmark, yes. You can't just glue a chip on it and then you're okay, but it has to go, you have to have this circumvention. Gentleman right here. So the question is, you know, where you refill the ink, is that some kind of circumvention? It's certainly circumventing the business model, but it's not circumventing the access control to the software on the chip. So refilling it would be okay under the law. I say that you can't give a straight answer because hypotheticals are complicated, but that's a straight answer that I'm going to give to this. So. He asked why the patent wouldn't be enough to protect it. And that's a very good question. The patent would be enough were it patented. And it may have, actually, this may have been a patented process, and they may have also prevailed on the patent ground, but the issue in this appeal, I don't know what the underlying lawsuit was and all the causes of action. Patent protects a process. It doesn't have anything to do with copying. If you patent a process, then nobody else can use that process, even if it's independently derived, until after the patent has expired. So if it was patented, they couldn't do it. It would protect it. So one suggestion that somebody had made to me was, well, this was just one of many remedies that the company sought, but a patent would protect it were it patented. Okay, one more and then we're going to move on. His question is, how many people think the DMCA really sucks? Okay, how many people think it's okay? How many people, it's a brave gentleman over there. How many people are undecided? Some undecided people. Well, let's see how we feel about it after we talk about the exceptions. Have some activists here. I like seeing that. Okay, so... So we talked about the DMCA. It has a relatively broad reach. I think the reaction that it gets in a crowd like this is more generally on the negative side, but I mention my colleagues and my colleagues' comments on the Lexmark case just to show you that in business circles there's a kind of a different prevailing view. Now that I work in an academic institution, I like to give both sides of the story. It's not in my nature, but it's in my job, so... There are exceptions to the DMCA, and I'm going to talk about three ones that are relevant to the issue of vulnerability research and disclosure. Those are security testing, encryption research, and reverse engineering. The security testing exception applies if the information derived is used solely to promote the security of the owner or operator of the tested computer system, or the information obtained is shared directly with the development of the system, and it is not distributed in a way that might enable copyright infringement or other legal violations. So again, we're seeing something kind of enshrined in the statute that the way you communicate the information and the audience to whom you communicate matters to whether liability attaches, matters to whether there's a potential exception. Sir. So he asked me about the Felton case. In this case, Ed Felton, a Princeton computer security professor, and some colleagues of his entered a challenge that the record industry put up. The challenge was, could you break, was it SDMI? Could you break SDMI, the Secure Digital Music Initiative, copyright or encryption technology that was supposed to prevent infringement of songs and to help track songs from being original or pirated copies? And they found that SDMI didn't work in a number of ways. They then had a choice. Under the rules of the contest, you report it to the RIAA and they pay you $10,000, or you can publish it. And being law, academic professors, they wanted to publish. And they received a letter from the industry threatening them and saying, if you publish this, you are we think you're going to be liable under the DMCA. Subsequently, the industry kind of went back on that, backpedaled on that, and the paper was published. I don't think that the DMCA, I don't think that there is a real valid legal argument that the DMCA applies to pure speech that has only a communicative function and does not include code or something that is a tool. I think that the record industry actually really, I think the statute's broad, but I don't think it's that broad. And were it that broad, I'm confident that the First Amendment, which we'll talk about in a little bit, would have to act to narrow the scope of the statute so that it couldn't reach purely academic communication. And we'll talk about why I'm pretty confident that that's true. But I think that the Felton case was an example of what happens when you have a law that's very broad and it can be used in a way to intimidate people from reporting security vulnerabilities. That in itself, though not, I think, legally accurate, is a real failing or flaw in a law when it is so broad that those kinds of claims can credibly be made. The encryption research exception applies to professional cryptographers. So if you have your little badge that says, I'm a professional certified cryptographer, this could apply to you. The professional cryptographer, I only know one. the professional cryptographer must seek advance permission to do the research. The question was, does he have to be granted permission? He doesn't have to be granted permission, but he has to ask, go through the motions of asking. If you have permission, you don't need an exception, I suppose. The research must be necessary to advance the state of the art. It must advance the state of knowledge in the field. And the way in which the results are published cannot promote infringement, copyright infringement. So I think the consensus on this would probably be this is a pretty narrow exception. The question is, how do they define a professional cryptographer? And I think that that's something that we're going to have to wait and see, because we're going to have to wait until some somewhat amateurish cryptographer violates the DMCA and sues and the exception is tested on appeal. It's not clear to me from the statute what the definition of a professional cryptographer is. Who do you ask? You must. Who do you have to ask for permission to do the research? You have to ask for permission from the copyright holder of the thing that you're doing the research on. Then there's the reverse engineering exception. Reverse engineering exception applies only if the purpose is to achieve program-to-program interoperability, if the reverse engineering is necessary, and if the information is divulged for the sole purposes of enabling the interoperability, not in another way or for another purpose. Yes. Why didn't this apply to the printer case? That was not program-to-program interoperability, if I remember correctly. That's what I think the case said. I will look that up, but in my recollection of the case was that the court said that wasn't program-to-program interoperability. In these exceptions, in reverse engineering exception, the encryption research exception, all of those must be true. In a security testing, you need one of the first two and the second. So those first two are actually 1A and 1B. Okay, that's the DMCA for you. So let's just do the test again. How many people here think the DMCA really sucks? Okay, so that looks like more. How many people remain undecided? Okay, so there's one agnostic in the back. And how many people think it's okay? I like that. Don't change your mind for us. Oh, is he? Okay, so let's move to the second major area of potential of question about the DMCA. Okay, so he's saying that he covered the Elcom case and talked to the jurors, and that in fact they did believe that the company didn't have the intent to break the law, and that was the grounds on which they found them not guilty. And I think the interesting thing about that is that the case was won, well, it's interesting for a lawyer, the case was won on jury instructions, because the jury instructions said they had to have the intent to break the law. They were able to argue that and win, as opposed to they had to have the intent to distribute something circumventing, which clearly they did have that intent. They were in the business of marketing that. So it's a case that's won on the jury instructions. And for those of you who are budding lawyers out there, the jury instructions are the most important part of any case. Yes? The law itself does not have an element that says you have to intend to violate the law. Very few laws actually do have that specific kind of intent. Yeah, so it's weird. Okay. The cybercrime treaty. This was something that was, I see a frisbee, so I can't help but call on that person. Yes. You know, I think that's definitely one of the problems with this exception is that the distribution of the information can enable unauthorized access by giving otherwise clueless people the information they need to gain that access. And so if you distribute it publicly, then it seems like you're not meeting the second element of this security testing exception. And I think the idea is that they want this exception to apply only to people who give the vulnerability information directly to the party whose system is vulnerable, not maybe to the public at large. The cybercrime, yes. People love the DMCA. because the vendor revealed the information? Again, I don't think that the revelation of pure information is a violation of the DMCA. The patch is something that, in the way that it's written, is something that doesn't take advantage or circumvent the technological protection measure, but something that repairs the technological protection measure, then maybe that wouldn't come under the DMCA either, and the company's actions would be legal and fine. So, yes? The patch communicates the scope of the vulnerability, and so on the flip side, the patch tells you something about the vulnerability, and then that information does give you ideas of how to circumvent the, or maybe even a tool on how to circumvent the protection measure, and that's why vulnerability is this double-edged sword, where what helps can be used to hurt and vice versa. And that's one of the reasons why a law like the DMCA seems kind of like a sort of a blunt instrument to deal with this problem, because the real issues are the ones that I sort of talked about earlier, which is questions of how to promote responsible security reporting, and doing something like this kind of calls a lot of things that are responsible into potential question. So I will take the question is, isn't the owner of the person who, or isn't the party issuing the patch usually the copyright owner? But what about this? And here's my own hypothetical. The patch repairs my Windows operating system. On my computer that runs Windows, I have my own copyrighted stuff. So somebody uses that, let's say, patch or exploit to circumvent the security measures of my Windows machine, and then thereby gains access to copyrighted work, my copyrighted work, not Microsoft's, and there you have it. So, he should come up here and do that, but yes, that's true. He's talking about the license agreement, and the licensing agreements will say, are a waiver of liability for the vendor. So the problem with that is that, you know, they say, well, we're not going to be liable for anything. We don't care. We're not warranting to you that it works the way it's supposed to work or anything. And you're basically out there on your own. And there's the license. There's some question, you know, are those licenses enforceable? This is another presentation that I have done in the past. There are statutes that there's a statute that a lot of that's proposed in a lot of states that would make the terms of these types of software licenses, shrink wrap, click wrap, and browse wrap licenses, enforceable. That law is called UCEDA, and it's something that, again, you should be really careful to watch out for in your local area. So I'm going to take Carol's question, and then I'm going to move on. Carol was pointing out that, was it the Slammer worm? With Slammer, a company, a firewall company, put out the patch for that, or a way to detect it. And there's an example, again, of a non-copyright holder issuing the patch. In the Cybercrime Treaty, there are, I believe, still currently 32 signatories, including the United States. The treaty does three basic things. It lists a number of activities. Thank you. It lists a number of activities that each member country must criminalize. It grants search and seizure powers to law enforcement, including forcing an ISP to preserve internet usage records and requiring countries to pass laws that enable real-time monitoring. The United States already has and has had a wiretap law that authorizes law enforcement to do so in approved criminal investigations, but it requires other signatory countries to do that as well. And it requires law enforcement to assist police from other participating countries in investigating the crimes that fall under the Cybercrime Treaty. The issue is Article 6 of the treaty, let me just finish this and I'll get to you. The issue is Article 6 of the treaty, which prohibits illegal devices. It prohibits computer programs which are designed or adapted primarily for the purpose of gaining unauthorized access to computers, intercepting data, or interfering with computer systems. So this actually caused kind of an outcry. This is an example where there was some activism at the international level by security experts, and it made a difference. It didn't get rid of Article 6, but it did change the treaty so that signatory countries may allow devices if they are for not for the purpose of committing an offense. So this makes it, you don't have to outlaw all of these types of devices. You can have an exception for legitimate security testing and research, and it specifically says that in the treaty. So the idea, I think, is to sort of criminalize hacker tools when they are being used for unauthorized access purposes. So there's a question over there. How to determine intent is from the circumstances surrounding the offense. So, for example, let's take a normal case that people will be familiar with, a screwdriver. A screwdriver is a burglary tool. You can use it to break into a car. But we can all carry around screwdrivers, which is perfectly fine. But if we're carrying around screwdrivers and we're in a parking lot and our car is not there and they find us with our screwdriver poised at the door of the car, then that's circumstantial evidence of intent and the person was about to use it as a burglary tool and you can be convicted for that. So, you know, you never know what dark shadows the human mind might hold, but circumstances allow you to make an educated guess as to that, and that's sufficient for the law. Well, did you have a question? So the question is, I like your question because it's going to allow me to show you something that's just about how like crazy the law is. Weld's question was, well, let's say I do the security testing once and then I'm just not going to do it anymore. Am I obligated to get rid of the tools? And this, look at the language of the treaty. The treaty says signatories may allow the devices if they are not for the purpose of committing offense. It doesn't say signatories may allow the devices if they are for the purpose of legitimate security testing. So it's sort of like everything but using them for offense is allowed, as opposed to only using them for legitimate testing. So the way they phrase it gives you this much, gives us more leeway to make them legal in every case except when they're for the illegal purpose. And we fight over stuff like this. Say again? That's the excellent point. He says, well, then it just ends up being an added penalty to something that's already illegal. And in fact, that's true because of Emerson's question about how you prove intent. It's going to be that this is something that people are charged and convicted for in circumstances in which they're actually gaining unauthorized access. And in essence, it's kind of an enhancement for unauthorized access crimes. And you wonder, do we really want to have a criminal penalty enhancement for unauthorized access crimes when most crimes are going to involve some kind of hacker tool? Why don't we just make the penalty, if we really want to do that, why don't we just make the penalty for unauthorized access higher in the first place and just forget this whole hacker tool law? So I think that's an excellent point. So I'll take this gentleman here and then. So he brought up the DirecTV cases. We are actually in the process of creating an online legal resource for people who have been caught up in the DirecTV juggernaut. Basically what happened is DirecTV sued a number of companies that were selling devices for intercepting DirecTV. They then took the customer lists, they won, companies went out of business. They took the customer lists for these companies and they sent a cease and desist letter, including a sample complaint for a lawsuit, to everyone on the customer lists of these companies, regardless of what devices they purchased, saying, we know you bought that device to intercept DirecTV and we're gonna sue you. The law is actually not that broad. DirecTV is wrong. The mere possession of a smart card reader or an emulator or some of these other devices is not illegal under the law. So they've gone too far in that case. Those would be, obviously, well, maybe not obviously, a different law applies that has to do with the laws about intercepting cable and intercepting electronic communications. Is not exactly a DMCA case, but they read those statutes far too broadly. The law often is trying to walk this line between allowing the legitimate purposes of devices while inhibiting or curtailing the illegitimate purposes. And since something like a smart card reader can be used for, and many tools, like a screwdriver, can be used for good and evil, the law is trying to make these discriminating calls about when we make it illegal or when we try to limit that possession of the device and when it's going to be okay. One of the problems, I think, is that in this digital arena, the law doesn't do a very good job because there's not a lot of education. It's not common knowledge or common experience among legislators as to what would necessarily be a delicate balance. Okay, my favorite part, the First Amendment. Can the First Amendment save us? If not, people in other countries, can it save us, we Americans? This is what the First Amendment says. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. It is one of the amendments that people still love. Nobody likes the Fourth Amendment. That's my favorite. And people just don't understand the Fifth Amendment, self-incrimination, but the people still get sort of a nice, warm, patriotic feeling over the First Amendment. So the question is, will the First Amendment help us here? Are instructions speech, if you're giving instructions on how to exploit? And the answer to that is yes, instructions are speech, but they're not going to be protected speech if they are part of a criminal act. And there are a number of cases that have addressed this issue in different contexts. A software program that is a bookmaking program was found to be speech, but the interstate transportation of that program as part of an illegal bookmaking conspiracy or illegal bookmaking the intent to promote illegal bookmaking, illegal gambling, was not protected by the First Amendment. Mailing the PCP instructions, I talked about that case already. Though the instructions themselves would have been protected, the person, the mailing of them with the intent to aid and abet the production of PCP was not something that the First Amendment, protected. I think before I said that in that case the person was convicted of the conspiracy or convicted of aiding and abetting, the case actually involved the question of whether a search warrant was legitimate solely on the basis that that this person had mailed the PCP instructions. And the court said, well, the First Amendment's not going to intercede here and invalidate the search warrant. Sort of some creative lawyering there. But the court did say he must have that special criminal intent to aid and abet in order to be convicted. There are a ton of cases in this area as to when instructions might violate the law in the tax fraud area, because there are a lot of people out there who like to not pay taxes, and there are a lot of people out there who want to help people not pay taxes. So there's a number of cases with some very complex jurisprudence about when you're just simply advocating tax avoidance, which is okay. It's okay to advocate an illegal activity, and when you're actually making that illegal activity happen in a way that is aiding and abetting. Okay, so that enabling tax fraud has, you know, if you're setting up the bogus tax shelters for people, that has been held to be something that the First Amendment does not protect. A Dangerous Sex Act. This is a great case. Well, I mean, it's sad, but it's a great case. it's a great case for the First Amendment, sad for the people involved. In this case, some surviving family members sued Hustler magazine for an article that they published on autoerotic asphyxiation, and their loved one had had died during a trial run, I suppose. So the court, a misadventure, yes. The court reviewed this and said, well, can Hustler be liable simply for publishing these instructions on this particular act? And said, no, the First Amendment protects this publication. It's not, even though they were giving instructions, there's no chance that the person would be imminently, upon publication, there's no imminent incitement to do the act. So the First Amendment protects the advocacy of, not to say that autoerotic asphyxiation is illegal, but it protects the advocacy of illegal acts, but it does not protect advocacy in a way that is likely to incite imminent criminal violations. And they said, well, with this publication of this article, there's no imminent incitement or incitement to imminent harm. Also, the magazine lacked the requisite criminal intent to cause people to do this. It was simply a informational article. Okay, so his question is, you know, why are these presentations not actually, you know, what's the difference really between this advocating an illegal act and inciting a legal act? And this is a case that is sort of one of the seminal First Amendment cases, Brandenburg versus Ohio. And what the Brandenburg case says is that advocacy of unlawful behavior is First Amendment protected. People need to be able to say, we're going to get together and we're going to block the street and we're going to protest and, you know, we don't care. They also allow advocacy of stuff that's maybe not as, you know, political, like tax avoidance, or maybe that is political, or pot smoking or bomb making or something like that. But what they don't want is they don't want to incite imminent legal activity. Brandenburg says that there's a narrow class of speech which incites imminent illegal activity and that that is illegal. So I can tell you guys right here that you should get up and you should go and let's burn the White House down. And I'm going to be okay. Brandenburg's going to protect me. But if we were standing on the White House steps and I had a torch in my hand and I said the exact same thing, no. So I'm giving you kind of two, you know, extremes, and as I said before, the law likes to figure out how to, you know, deal with all the sort of fuzzy in between, but those are sort of your two outside extremes between mere advocacy and incitement. My time's over, isn't it? I started a little bit late, so I'm just going to go through this. There's trade secret misappropriation is also another way in which pure speech can be something that's criminal. If you learn a trade secret, for example, under some kind of fiduciary relationship or a contract or non-disclosure agreement, and you disclose that trade secret, that is speech, but it is criminal, and the First Amendment does not intercede to protect you. There is a case that's currently on appeal in California, which is a very interesting case. In that case, a person distributed an alleged trade secret. This was that same DCSS computer program. But the court said, well, he's not the person who misappropriated the trade secret. He's an innocent republisher. He found the trade secret and he was simply republishing it. And the case said that the First Amendment protects the republication of trade secret information by an innocent party who's not the one who breached his fiduciary relationship to keep the information secret or breached a contract. So we'll see whether that case manages to be upheld on appeal. Pay no attention. Okay, this is a, do we have to stop? Okay, thank you. I'll go rapidly because I don't want people to feel beholden to staying if they're ready to go. It's been a long, I know it's been a long day. So our tool, speech. Well, you guys will all be happy to know that source code is speech. And not only is source code speech, but object code is also speech. This is because arcane though it is, it's the way that computer programmers communicate ideas to each other. You know, when you read these cases and you have these federal judges saying, you know, I think even object code is speech, you just really see what good lawyering can do and being able to communicate to the judge why these ones and zeros are speech worthy of the protection of our First Amendment. The Bunner case, which I mentioned earlier, they said, well, object code's not speech, it's just ones and zeros, nobody can understand what that is. I don't know if they've seen The Matrix, but clearly some people can understand it. So does the First Amendment protect exploits? Well, software has a special nature because it is both communicative and functional. It both communicates to computer scientists who can read the code ideas, but it also does something. It is a tool. The communicative aspect is protected by the First Amendment. That's the speech aspect, and First Amendment says that there cannot be any regulation or impairment of that unless the government has a compelling state interest and uses the least restrictive means necessary. So this is a hard test to pass. When you are talking about protecting speech and you get this test, the pure strict scrutiny First Amendment test, very few regulations can actually meet this standard. If there's any more narrow way to do it, than to address the concern, then the statute or the regulation will fail. However, the communication can be regulated if there's a sufficiently important government interest in regulating the non-communicative or the functional aspects, a law that is targeted at function, not at communication. So in the case that really discussed this, this deals with the DCSS case, the court said, well, DMCA, this law, addresses tools, exploits, that circumvent technological protection measures. That's a statute that's not focused on the communicative aspect of these software programs. It's something that's focused on the functional aspect of the software program. So yes, the First Amendment is implicated because you're regulating programs, and programs are speech. But you're not regulating the programs because of what they're saying, you're regulating them because of what they do. And when you regulate because of what it does, you don't get the compelling state interest, least restrictive means test, you get an intermediate level of scrutiny, and the statute or the regulation is going to be upheld if there's a sufficiently important government interest. And the court held that the DMCA, that the government does have a sufficiently important interest that supports the DMCA, and so the DMCA does not violate the First Amendment. DMCA is okay. It's not targeting speech. It's targeting function. Yes. So the question is, what if I released an exploit that was not functional? Some part of it was disabled, so it's not actually functional. First of all, it wouldn't violate the statute because it's not something that circumvents protection measure. It doesn't work, right? So then the second question is, would the First Amendment protect it? And the issue is sort of a as applied versus, you know, it's statutory question. The statute itself is First Amendment, it is okay with the First Amendment, doesn't violate the First Amendment because it addresses the functional aspect, not the communicative aspect. There are situations where you could argue, well, in this particular case, as it applies to me, it's violating my speech rights because it's preventing me from saying or doing this, kind of an as-applied challenge. And that's like sort of a legally kind of different thing. But I think the real answer is, if it doesn't work, it's not circumventing. So you. So his question is, what if it's just trivially easy to make it work? And, you know, I mean, I love these questions, but I think that, you know, this is one of these things under the statute. What does the statute mean when it says it's a circumvention tool? I mean, if it's trivial, then it really does work. It's just like turning a switch on. I mean, you can analogize it both ways. One is, it doesn't work, and it's just purely communicative. The other is, well, it's just like turning a switch on. The light may be off, but it still works. Right. So which will the law say? Okay. Okay, before we lose the projector. So we are going to have a conference at the school that I work at on these issues. This is going to be, we're in one conference in November, which is going to be about research and disclosure, particularly about these issues having to do with disclosure, but more issues than that.